Who knows how old Caleb was when he did something wonderful for God? Very good. You almost answered. I think you said right. Who tried to say? That's very close anyway. So we give you 98%. All right, but at least you were brave and you were very close. So that's wonderful. No more questions tonight. All right, Joshua, the lovely book of Joshua. I think you all know this story, wonderful. And for want of time, I'm going to just read a few of these verses and sparsely, because this is quite a story, but you all know it, I hope, even the children. Caleb in Joshua 14, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said unto him, to Joshua, thou knowest the thing that the Lord said unto Moses, the man of God, concerning me and thee and Kadesh Barnea. 40 years old was I when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to espy out the land, and I brought him word again as it was in mine heart. Nevertheless, my brethren that went up with me made the heart of the people melt. But I wholly followed the Lord my God. And Moses swear on that day, saying, surely the land whereon thy feet have trodden shall be thine inheritance and thy children's forever, because thou hast wholly followed the Lord my God. And now behold, the Lord hath kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years, even since the Lord spake this word unto Moses, while the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness. And now, lo, I am this day 85 years old. As yet I am as strong this day as I was in the day that Moses sent me. As my strength was then, even so is my strength now for war, both to go out and to come in. Now therefore, give me this mountain. Give me this mountain whereon the Lord spake, whereof the Lord spake in that day. For thou knowest, thou heardest in that day how the Anakims were there, and the cities were great and fenced. If so be the Lord will be with me, then I shall be able to drive them out, as the Lord said. And Joshua blessed him, and gave unto Caleb the son of Jephunneh Hebron for an inheritance. Hebron therefore became the inheritance of Caleb. Hebron, I've been there. How many have been to Israel? Oh my, there you are. You've been to Hebron. That was where the patriarchs were buried. There's Abraham and Isaac. I think Rachel's tomb is just elsewhere for the circumstance when she died. But right down, there's all the very tombs. Very amazing to stand there and see the tombs that were built, not later on, but in their time. And survived all these years. You've got to go down the ground a bit. It's all in sort of a cave issue now because of the landscape changing, but it's really lovely. Hebron is very, very precious on both sides of religions, which is why there's so much war in that area. It's so coveted, because Abraham was the father of many religions, not just the Jewish religion, you know. He bore other sons, which we know of historically and even to this day in the front pages of the newspapers. And all the conflict going on and on and on about Hebron is something. But anyway, that was the mountain that he was speaking about. Now, This is an amazing statement. Have you ever thought of what he said? He has the same strength today, 85 years old, 84 years old, as he was when he was a young man. I'm the same. I wonder if he really meant that. I mean, I would like any 80-something-year-old man to stand up and please say with a pure heart, you're exactly the same, as strong as you were when you were a young man. No different. That's quite some statement, isn't it? Anyway, one has to be careful what you say about such people, and especially about statements of such a man. You know, if I have to be honest, I'm 62, in case anyone doesn't know it, and I'm still alive, but I'm 62, but in all honesty, I feel just the same as I did when I was 16 years old. Now, you may say that's ridiculous. He's just going too far now. But of course, when I look in the mirror, I know I'm haven't got all that long to live. That's why God lets us age, to know, don't waste time. This is just a soul being to say you have a time that's once and for all, in all eternity, that you can do something for God. In heaven, you can't win a soul. In heaven, you can't even pray for a soul. Nothing. For all eternity, for the Christ, in as far as serving to win what he died for. Well, of course, you realize, but in all honesty, you might not think this, but back in my country, people get to know about it, and I get into a lot of situations where I just don't know how to face crowds, you know, because I honestly feel the same. I feel as strong. I don't feel any weaker. I don't feel less of a person. And so you don't even bother about the mirror unless you have to, just before you preach, to see just that it's not so. But I walk every day normally for a few kilometers. I would say 9, 10, 11, how many miles? I don't know, 5, 6 miles sometimes more daily. In any town I am, up in the hills, the mountain towns, the big cities, either in the fumes of the cars if I have to, but I walk. And I pray. And sometimes I've been stopped by the police, because they think I'm crazy, a crazy man. But I have to tell them, well, come and see what I'm preparing and praying for, and you might get saved from hell. And then they get in their car and go. That's happened in America when they stopped me, the police. But I walk, and I don't only walk, but when I know many towns, everybody knows who this is by this time. But you're walking along, you know, and you're walking and praying, and I don't just stay on my knees. You die if you just spend your hours and your days. That's not spiritual. So I walk to stay alive, and I sometimes run. Can you believe it? I look around, because people don't like to see an old man with gray hair, always normally in a suit like this, you know, not a tie always, but anyway. And I run, and I look around, no one's looking, and you can't believe. And I don't try and impress myself or anything. I don't even try and prove anything to myself. I love to run. All the oxygen comes up here, and I'm memorizing scriptures. And I find you learn 10, 15, sometimes I would say close to 20 times more in a day if you run every now and again, the oxygen in your brain, rather than try and sit at a desk or on your knees. Because no oxygen comes to you, you can't memorize. And it's retained 10, 15, 20 times more. It's so retained if you just get the oxygen. So I run, not just for my health, not just to stay alive, but to serve God and to do the one thing he gave me. Get memory of the scriptures. Nonetheless, people do see me. And unfortunately, I've made some mistakes in some towns. I was running in one town, brother, and all these young preachers were running. And I didn't even know who they were. And I was running past them. And I was really involved in prayer, I must be honest with you. You might think it's not reverent to pray when you run, but honestly, sometimes I'm talking to God about things that I'm suddenly aware of, and I'm crying out. And of course, I running. Now, these fellows were running. And after a while, I decided, man, let me get away. So I just passed the whole lot of them. And they couldn't face me after that, you know. That this old man just ran past them, you know. So be careful. Maybe he told the truth. And maybe all the younger ones there who just were getting a bit of pain here and there were all thinking, he's true. And a bit shame to look at him, but it's the truth. Some people really are amazing. I wouldn't say I am, but as far as health's concerned, this man did have something wonderful, and I believe with all my heart that he was truly the same strength as when he was a young man and did great things for God. Now, I remember a young man called Colin Peckham. He is now about 80 years old, but what a lovely man. What a wonderful man. One of the few people I've known in my life that he didn't bury one opportunity on one occasion in his entire life that he could have done anything for God, he did it. With all his heart and what he's done for God in this world. From a young man. But you know how God got hold of him? He was on his knees in a prayer meeting. And he was groaning to God, just saved, young, but full of fire. And he was groaning all these godly missionaries. And he was crying out as a young preacher what everybody else was praying. As a young Christian, he was crying out, "Oh God, send forth laborers into the field. Oh God, the harvest is white plentiful, but the laborers are few. Souls are dying, God." And he was groaning, "Send, only thou can send, and lay hold of young people, God. Lay hold of young lives. Get people who are willing to put their lives on the altar and send." And while he was praying, a man began to laugh. Now, have you ever been in a prayer meeting when somebody laughs at someone praying? I mean, that's obnoxious. That's shocking. But this was one of the godliest men Africa ever knew. There's books written on his life. He died shortly after that. But what he did for God while he lived just shook parts of Africa. But this man was in the prayer meeting. And he began to laugh. But he didn't just giggle. He roared with laughter. He laughed so loud at this young man's praying earnestly, crying out for God to send out laborers, the desperate need of people to give their lives and go out and win the perishing souls on the mission field, that they stopped the prayer meeting. Of course, this young fellow was blood red and looking at who it was. Everybody knew who it was, laughing and roar. So he got up, and everybody got up. The prayer meeting was finished with all the laughter of this man. And everybody was shocked. But he walked up, still laughing, and he put his hand on this young man's shoulder, and he says, "Brother, you are going to have to answer your own prayer. You are going to have to be the answer of what you've just prayed." And he walked out. And Colin Peckham, from that moment, couldn't recover. God wanted his life. He thought of others. He was crying in earnestness for others. Yes, others, but not me. There was not a consideration that he could be meaningful for God, that he could be used by God. And yet he was earnest until somebody was so shaken that he didn't realize he had no right to pray like that when he was young on the altar and all that. That man gave up everything within moments of life because of the way that godly man had laughed in that meeting and said those words to him. And Peckham has been I only know one other man in my whole life who was so consumed to serve God that he actually left everyone everywhere right to this day bewildered at how he pours his soul out. Most people talk about doing something. Peckham, when he saw what any opportunity there was in any field of which in any capacity he could in any way do something for God, whether it was singing with young people, brother, he took choirs around Africa. In the end. And his voice wasn't wonderful. It was like a cracking voice. But he tried. He made. I can't go on. They should write a book on Peckham, Mr. Peckham's life. But what God did through that man. He was consumed with the things of God. Every breath in his body. You had to get on fire being near Mr. Peckham. You had to. You were obligated. You just had to get a fire because the fire was so burning. You just caught on fire. Again, to this day, the man is, get on the phone, you're just shaken. And he's 80. He's ablaze for God. Hallelujah. But here was a man who needed to know. Do you remember Moses? When God required something of Moses, do you remember what Moses said to God? Words quite a few people said. "I cannot." Those are the literal words he said to God. "Not me. I cannot. I cannot. I cannot speak." You know, God was angry. Do you know that God was angry? Do you know why God was angry? He was angry not only with Moses, Go back, read. God was angered and spoke in anger and indignation that a man was saying no to God. Not only was Moses there, Jeremiah. He cried, I cannot. Ezekiel, I cannot. When God called them, I cannot speak. I'm but a child. Not me, God. I cannot. Amazing how we put ourselves into the category. You know what Charles Finney said? If God commands you to do something, it is the highest possible evidence, equal to an oath, that you can do it. I'm going to repeat that. When God commands you to do anything, to do something, it is the highest possible evidence equal to an oath that you can do it. God said, say not, I cannot. And God even warned him, warned Jeremiah, warned Ezekiel, lest I be angered with you and your life, oh, turned you, God really confronted him. You stop this. Don't you say I cannot. When God tells you, you can, and God tells you, you must. Don't argue with God. You anger God. You can. To say I cannot is ridiculous. Here was a man, Caleb, 84 years old, and he was consumed with one goal. And you want to show me a tragedy, you show me a Christian who has no goal left in life, even if you're 80. Show me any Christian on earth that isn't driven and consumed with fulfilling a God-given goal. And don't you tell me there's no goal, sir, for an 80-year-old man. Well, you have breath, you have something to be consumed with, and if you're not, there's something wrong with you spiritually in this world. There's no such a thing as you have breath left in life that you haven't got some mountain to still conquer for God. And by faith, take it. And not to say, I cannot, I've reached the age of retirement, you know. I've had time to sit back now. Tell me, my son looked at me and said, Daddy, when is Daddy going to retire? You know, I was taken aback. I actually took a few steps back in shock. I've never thought of this. Retire? Daddy won't retire. Sorry, Daddy. Everybody was... I thought there was like 60, 65. You know, everybody retires or something. So I thought about it. I walked in a few circles and I was amazed that he actually considered that I could retire. I said, how do you retire from soul winning? At what point do you sit back and say, no more souls? What else does Daddy do? How does a preacher stop preaching? Wesley was 80, what, 88, the last sermon, weeks before he died. How many preachers, the greatest achievements they ever did in life was in their 70s and 80s with the great knowledge they had. When did Will MacFarlane, way in his 80s, when he preached, he had more effect in one sermon than when he was a young man and able to preach a whole series. His one sermon outshone, outweighed anything of the youngster and the anointing and the fruit that God did in all the other sermons of the whole convention. But he worked on that sermon. And he gave himself. And he had impact far more than the young ones who didn't have the knowledge, the anointing, the way to handle this word. When do you retire from serving God? I don't know about paperwork and all that, but I do know this. How does a man stop praying for souls? And what on earth is my life? Woe is me if I preach not the gospel. I pity a person who's not consumed, totally consumed, with some goal given at any point of life. In our country, I come from a mission that is now, I believe, the oldest surviving missionary society in Africa that has survived totally just survival as a mission. One single mission. There were missions before our mission, but do you know how it started? Now, this is going to shake you. It shook me. Three little ladies, came from Ireland, Northern Ireland. They were pretty much aristocracy. They were very wealthy. And they had wealth, but they decided to come. Now, they were godly. They were so godly and ablaze, and they were soul winners, prayer warriors. And in their witnessing, they started to witness to police. They weren't permanently in Africa, but they were deciding to come across to Africa. And as they were witnessing to these certain policemen, these policemen were so shaken that they on their knees seeking God. And these policemen were influential and said, "We want you to share this with everyone." They called the whole police force in one capacity. The next thing, hundreds of South African police were coming to God through three little women, bent, who stood there with a blazing faces, sharing from their hearts the gospel of Christ, sharing in their own capacity what God can do. The police turned so that Andrew Murray, who was revered throughout this nation, looked at these women and so revered them that I've read documents that he wrote to them of how they were so in his heart what God had done, what God had started in that country. Now, of course, they were women. They phoned back to the faith mission, John George Govan. He was saved through the great William Booth. And he had founded a mission where they had had theological training as younger girls, younger ladies, because they were very conservative and they wanted to get doctrinal foundation. So they went and attended this for a few years. But here they now in their old age, touring, and suddenly all these doors, and they said, "Listen, send workers from your mission to take over. We're ladies, we're three women. We want you to..." He said, "We have no workers. There's no one to send. You're there, God's winning souls. You carry on." Now that was a shock. That was a shock coming from this godly man. In the end, men, godly men, were raised up, young fellows. And of course, one very godly man did come from Britain. The great Captain Dobby. Books and books are written on his family. Generals, colonels, admirals. The Dobby family is famous in the history of the British armies and warfares. And he, with Montgomery, and he was on a par, apart from the fact that, well, we won't go into the history of them. But this man loved God. This man loved God. And here he comes along and she said these words, Helena Garrett, "I give everything into your hands. I held everything. Now I do what God wants. I put everything into the man's hands. I'm under your authority. I'll pray for you. I'll be here for you. I'll get the doors open, but I want the men to take over." Do you know, young men from all over Southern Africa and other countries of the world came as they knew what God had started through three little frail women. She always gave authority. She just put it straight into the hands. The moment there was a man, she did what God wanted. She didn't want authority. But she had been the one who God used, especially Helena, the eldest of the three sisters, the three Garrett sisters. Now, they are revered across Africa. No one questions whether it was God. Hundreds, there was no mission that won so many souls to God for so many years across Southern Africa and into Africa as this mission these three ladies had found. It was God. It was God. But here they were. They took and didn't sit down and say, "Not us, not me. This isn't right." You know? God said, "Cursed is the nation. Cursed is the nation whose leader is a woman." And then God chose Deborah. Because there was no man available that could fulfill what he had. Be careful. Be careful. This was a foundation of something that was great that started in those days. To say, "I cannot..." To is not be consumed with something for the glory of God, whether you're a woman or a man. To be restricted to all the restrictions of men or your own. To say, "I cannot put myself..." When God holds out to me the opportunity, no matter who I am, "I cannot," is a shameful thing. A deeply shameful thing. At what point do you give up being consumed with a God-given goal. You know, when I was a young preacher, the Lord did something very precious. I've seldom ever said this. And I won't go into details, but the Lord somehow took hold of this nothing. I suppose if you want to find a closer word to that, that was all I was. What was I going to amount to? And somehow put in my heart to memorize this book. People have asked me, how much of the book have you memorized? I said, don't start that. I don't know. I don't even want to ever consider it, lest I grieve God. But when I think of how it started, how God spoke in such a way that I was stunned. I was so stunned after working hours through the day that I couldn't sleep. All the other missionaries who had put tents up, we didn't have buildings, and they had the great conventions that just went over. I put up 50 tents a day as crowds would come from across Southern Africa to these great conventions. Until we got convention centers, we used to put up the tents. And we were tired and worn and blisters, and everybody else was, whoa. And I'm still awake because God was speaking to me all the time. He was just speaking somehow the voice of God in a most unusual way, that He wanted me to memorize and to bring the Word of God back to the church as it stands in its unadulterated form. And I said, but Lord, I how am I going to memorize? I wasn't good at school. In all honesty, I was a failure at school. Not many men would admit that, brother. But you know, honestly, I didn't realize I was at school to study. I thought I was at school for sport. I loved sport. Sport was like my God. And I didn't want to play just one sport. I had to be the best in everything. I left everybody overwhelmed. You can't believe how I wanted to be in this and that. And say, I don't tell me just to be in this one and that just because of the different seasons in Africa. I want to be involved. How can you be involved in everything? You know, one man called my father and said, you know, your son really shouldn't be playing rugby. He's too thin. He'll be smashed up. You've got to have, you know. And he said, but we can't say no to your son because he's the best. He's willing to die on the field to prove he can be the one who scores. So we can't say no. What are we going to do with your son? Well, anyway, I wasn't conscious that I was at school for anything else but sport. I thought that. I soon found out that I had made a mistake when I failed a whole standard and the humiliation and being left behind. But anyway, I wasn't a good student. But here I was now, asked by God to memorize passages. And I said, but Lord, I can't do this. It's not me. I'm not academic. I haven't got this. Something in my heart, tired that night, God said, I don't want you to memorize the whole Bible. This is impressive. I didn't hear a voice. I want you, only what burns from the pages of this book into your heart, I want you to memorize. For what burns into your heart from these pages will burn from your lips. And what burns from your lips will burn into the hearts of those. So I said, all right, Lord. And this was late in the night. It was close to 12 o'clock, 11:30. And I took a passage. I said, this passage burned into my heart. I took a chapter, Matthew 22. It just shook me. I said, I'm going to try. If this is God speaking to me, if this is thee, prove thyself now to me. I cannot. I haven't got the mind for this. Within, I think, 40 minutes, I'd memorized the chapter. Now, I began to tremble. I literally got up and started walking, trembling. It so shook me, it put fear in my heart. And I said, but this can't be. I actually argued with God, this can't be. And then I said, Lord, if this really is Thee, let me wake up and it's still there. And I woke up and grabbed the Bible and went, it was there. And then the Lord shook me even more and said, I want you to go out in the fields, and all the tents were all up and everything. Now there's a few days for us to recuperate and get at a steadier pace. You get away from people and memorize the Sermon on the Mount. And I want you to preach it. So I went out in the fields and God just put it in my mind, my heart. I went over and over. And then they said what they normally don't say to a young person. They don't lay hands on a novice. or give them any opportunity. You just wash the toilets. Put up tents. Give a testimony if you're lucky. If you've fought, if God is really going to honor you. But here they said, you're going to preach. It just doesn't do that to a young person. There were other preachers, for overseas preachers, etc. But you're going to preach in one of the meetings. You have 40 minutes. Go 1 minute over and I will pull you down, boy. They don't play the fool there, brother. So I prayed about it and the Lord just in my heart impressed, that's what I gave you, the sermon of the month. You've got a sermon, you don't have to work out a sermon. But I said, Lord, it takes 45 minutes to quote. They've given me 40 minutes. I won't be able to expound. People will say, well, why do we come here? We could have read that at home. You don't give any revelation. And the Lord in my heart impressed very deeply, in a very deep way. Wait until we're in heaven if you say it wasn't the Lord impressing in my heart. Trust me, I don't need you to do anything more than my word is capable of doing. So, the impression in my heart, I went over it, fasted, I stopped eating for the next few days. I wept, groaning for God to help me that it was as Jesus, that people would forget about as human, that it's just as Christ, what he emphasized, the way he said it, where he was grieved, that every word would be as Christ, God, by the Holy Ghost, let people just become conscious, this is as Christ gave it. I stood up, I preached, I sat down, but before I sat down, I was so shaken because I could hardly keep my eyes on the audience. You talk about legs moving, brother, and other things. I saw men writhing, and I'd never seen that in my life in a meeting. I saw people in dead silence sitting before, but writhing. They were in such agony. Men, I saw a man fall off his chair, crawl a bit inside, and no one looked at him, not even his wife. I'd never, ever known the presence of God in my entire life, the consciousness, by just the quoting of the Word of God. Now, why I'm bringing this is, yes, my life was consumed with this, but then I read a horrible statement. I read in the Time magazine. I like to read that magazine because it seems to have... I don't like newspapers very much. They're a little bit biased on politics, etc. But the Time seems to give generally good headlines. And I only read the small lighting if the Lord seems to tell me to. But I read there that medical science proves that millions of cells are just deteriorating in your brain. Did you know that as you're sitting here, you poor, poor people... Be careful. Time is running out. Millions! You can't believe how many millions of brain cells are just being destroyed all the time. But don't worry, they don't tell you how many billions of brain cells you've got. You've really got a long time. But they're very dramatic and sensational, you know. But anyway, they said, of course, your memory at the best at peak, and then it starts, you can't function, it doesn't. Things will get that you can't. You're achieving years of these years. So I said, what am I going to do when I can't memorize anymore? Now, I want to tell you something that I have never shared before. I'd like to share it tonight. I'm 62. I can memorize by God's grace because I am consumed with it for God's glory. I can memorize 10 times more scriptures now than I could when I was a young man of 20 when I started this. I say to the glory of God, and it took nearly over 40 years of preaching. Before I dared to even share it, said, don't tell me I'm trying to touch the glory, and I will not touch the glory. Because that's the one thing God said to me, touch the glory and I'll bury you, the day you say it. And it was God, because I watched him bury others who were far more anointed than I were, who were so with God in the pulpits. And I saw them touch the glory and God buried them. But why I'm saying it is, at what point does God want you to say, I'm going to stop now, I'm getting old? Brother, it's when you take your eyes off God. That you don't have, that you aren't consumed with a God-given goal. And I pity any Christian on earth who isn't consumed with a God-given goal, woman or man. Forgive me saying woman or man, but ladies, you're not excluded in the work of God. I want to tell you that from my heart. Maybe you keep silence in the church to the degree, like our missionaries, they will go out there and they'll lead men to Christ, but the moment that man's ready, they'll say, you take over. They don't want authority, but if there's no men there, and 80% of the mission field is women, because men won't go.
Don't tell me God doesn't send women then and use them. Oh, I pity anyone who names the name of Jesus that is not consumed with a goal that's given by God. I once met a lady by the name of Ellen White. Now, Ellen White was fearful. She was a lady, but she had one son. He was a godly boy and a wonderful person. I never met him, but I heard of this unique, refined character that everybody was expecting so much from. She had a godly husband, and both died within days. Her son killed, her husband killed. And this woman had no one left in life. And she sobbed. She stopped eating. She couldn't function. She was going. Her mind was going. All she did was sob until her whole head was numb and closed. And she couldn't function. She just kept on sobbing. Oh, God, let me die, she cried. I don't want to live. Everything was robbed of her that she loved, and her life was centered. And she said the Lord spoke to her. Now, be careful. 90-something% of people who told me God spoke to them, I asked a few questions and they weren't even saved. And don't you tell me you heard God speaking to you. I don't get too impressed about voices and all these things. But this woman was so godly, so revered in Southern Africa, that I was shaken when I realized. Ellen White said to me, God spoke to me of audible voice on my knees. I would have died. I think I was busy dying, and I would have died very soon. Nothing was going to save me. And God spoke and said, stop this weeping. Get up. I have a great work for you. You have much to do for my kingdom and my glory. She said, Keith, it was so real, I never shed another tear. In that moment, I got up. Every grief was gone. I was so in awe and staggered that I knew it was God. And this woman, she confronted us. She took hold of everyone. She cornered you. They said, be careful. There's a little lady called Ellen White. If she corners you, you're stuck. And I got cornered in the pantry. And I knew I'm stuck because they had warned me. Wow, did she tell me what not to do and what to do. She put the daily light into my hands. She's given it out to hundreds and hundreds. And what this woman just... She confronted ministers who were fearful of people who were going to throw them out of pulpits. She said, you get thrown out, but you don't compromise. She was such a force for God that she was feared, yet loved above most Christians I've ever known in my life by multitudes. This woman had an influence upon so many. She never preached once. But that doesn't mean you don't influence preachers, lady. I know preachers that would have left the pulpit and given up and ran miles. Even from their denomination, they were so humiliated. If it wasn't for that woman who said, you will not leave. You will not leave God's service. I actually heard her speaking to one man. Oh, what God did through this woman. Somehow she was used mightily by God. Here in your country, there's a woman by the name of Joyce Green, Texas. She's just died the other day, a few weeks ago, of cancer. Now, Joyce Green was Milton Green's wife. He was with Leonard Ravenhill, greatly used, especially in revival conference in the early days when not everybody was taken up with revival. But greatly revered, Milton Green. He was content to sit in the background of this great man of God and just be the wife and mother. But this woman suddenly was shaken when Milton Green, as a young man, now this is young, in the 40s, died. Unexpected. She also wept and wept and wept and wept and wept. Her whole life was just wiped away. To such a degree was her whole life was just the shadow of her husband, consumed by her husband's ministry and life, just to be there for him. She suddenly had nothing that she could do or function in. It was a woman suddenly robbed of every purpose that she loved this man so much, who who so was used of God. She was very close to Lillian Ravenhill, looked upon her as a daughter, till he died. Loved her for the way she lived. But this woman said she didn't hear her audible voice, but she had been crying for weeks, just groaning, couldn't eat, getting more and more frail, her mind less and less able to function, just closing, negative, just emptiness, no hope, and just being destroyed mentally and spiritually. And on her knees she said that it wasn't an audible voice, but there was some impression where God suddenly took hold of her and said, stop crying. No. She said it wasn't an audible voice, but I knew it was God. Within my innermost being, I knew God was reasoning with me. I have a work for you. Now get up and start. She said, Keith, it was so real that I stood up and the word perfect, not even knowing what Ellen White had told me the other side of the world. I never shed another tear for my husband. The moment I got up on my knees, it was gone. There was something of an awe that God had something for me, a purpose that I had to be committed to and consumed by. The Lord led her without ever hearing audible voices, because just before her husband died, he had entered into maximum security prisons. In Texas, that's where there's more maximum security prisons than anywhere else in the world. They have these massive buildings over and over. Texas is renowned worldwide for that, filled with people who mainly are there for life imprisonment, murderers who haven't faced death and other terrible crimes related to murder, but filled in their thousands and thousands. Now this woman had a husband who, just before he died, was given an opportunity to speak a few times, I think about three times if I'm still remembering right, and quite a number of these murderers, these very rough men, gave their lives to Christ in brokenness. And the Lord impressed on her to get into that prison and to take those men and to continue the work God had started through her husband in those prisons. She didn't really know what to do. She went in there as frail and as fearful as could be. Doesn't mean you walk in with no fear, you know. You're not, oh, I go, God is with me, I'm going to just look at the man and march through the gates. Oh, she was fearful. She didn't know what they were going to say, but they let her in when they heard who she was. Milton Green's wife. They sat her down with men that had come to Christ and a few others that were professing Christians. And she sat down and she said, look, I'm a woman, I can't preach. But I am going to teach you. You are going to be my men. She called that. They would all smile when she heard the my men. And I'm going to teach you, and you are going to preach. I'm going to teach you everything I know about doctrine and how to preach. I'm going to let you listen to tapes of my husband. I'm going to teach you to preach, and we are going to reach these prisons. Do you know so many prisoners turned to Christ through these men? The halls were filled with people who had been saved within no time. Born of God. It was such an impact and such transformed lives that they opened other maximum security prisons to her because the word spread. She had prison after prison after prison after prison open, and the people that she led to Christ, that these men led to Christ with her, because she trained them in every aspect, gave them books to follow up, everything she had learned from her husband, every aspect of what books to give, what tapes to give, of how to follow up. She just took these men and set ablaze as these prisoners in their hundreds turned to God and turned to God and turned to God and turned to God. The most amazing effect. She didn't stop there. When these men started coming to Christ and she used to sit with them and talk about their lives, what happened, why did you come here, where's your family, she started soon after these men started turning to Christ, she got their addresses, with the southern side of America, didn't matter, and she drove in a car, just tripping, and she knocked on the doors and found women who had given up their whole life, destroyed, no hope of survival, financially, children just going wild. Women who were broken and destroyed, their husbands been put in prison for life, many of them. And she said, she took these women and said, listen, stop crying. Stop giving up. There's no hope. There is hope. Come. Come with me. I will house you. I will feed you. I will clothe you. But I am going to long for God to save you as He saved your husband. Your husband's come to Christ. You can't marry someone else now. Even if he's there, he's your husband. You're going to visit him. Your children are going to go and see their father. He's become a man of God now. You're going to forgive him. If God forgives him, you have to forgive him. But you're coming to Christ. I'm going to take care of you, and you're going to, I'm going to train you to serve with me in the kingdom, for the kingdom of Christ. Somehow you're all going to function. She built hostels. Now, I'm not talking about some little building, brother. Hostels upon hostels, housing the families she took from across America who had no hope of survival. She clothed them, she fed them, she looked for God for money and finances to build these buildings. She had a big hall. I preached, you know. I preached in the day in these prisons. Here are these faces, all in prison uniforms. But faces so Christ-like, so refined, Bibles in tatters, falling apart. As godly as you could ever find outside of prison. These men are so godly. She wanted me to preach for them. As I walk from the pulpit, they're just weeping and just touching me. Oh, thank you. Thank you for sharing, for coming to us. What it meant, I just broke. I just broke as I saw the appreciation of these men. Their Bibles and tatters, they were godly in prison. And then, that's in the days and the nights. I preached to all their wives and all their children in this hall filled with them. Preaching the gospel, encouraging them to go on, not to give up, how to just, oh, it was just beautiful. This dear woman, she had me down, you know. One day, they let certain men, not everyone, a small percentage had been actually allowed out of prison. Different circumstances, and they were allowed out. And she has them out now, but that doesn't mean she let them go. She has them in these buildings there with their families, and she takes them into the prisons. And these men, they all are preaching. She doesn't preach. She doesn't stand there giving the word. She got these men. And she sat me down, and here was about 50 men. I'm thinking it was 50. In this big place with all these circular tables for feeding. She said, "Now, Brother Daniel, I have all these men. These are my men." She had a very great sense of humor, by the way. Lovely woman. She says, "I want some of you to share with Brother Daniel. As you want to, you stand up, or I'll make you stand up, your story and about Jesus and that the Lord has done for you." Oh, I murdered a man indirectly I was involved in, and I was put in for life, but they've let me out, but I came to Christ through this lady. And she taught me to preach, and that's my full-time work. We go in like a little army. My family's all come to Christ. She led them to Christ. Isn't it lovely? One after the other. I was in a restaurant with her one day, and they brought this little lady. You can't believe how she was dressed, so like the world. You just thought, how could anybody have been so destroyed? She was just brought in there, smashed to her husband, a young woman. Long hair all unkept, and this dress up here, and she didn't judge her and look at her and say, ooh. She just walked up. "Oh, they brought you here to the restaurant. I'm so sorry, my darling." She put her arms around this woman. She says, "You've come to me. I'm going to take care of you. Doesn't matter how your life's destroyed. Where are the children? I'm going to take care of you. You're going to come to Jesus. Did you know that? Brother Daniel, I guarantee you she's coming to Jesus. That's why God brought her to me." Oh, this woman had a compassion. She was consumed with what God could give a woman to do. Other women would say, "Well, let me sit down and find something to do, knitting, or involved in socializing, even if it's in church meetings." But she had something that consumed her life till she died. And many multitudes of those you and I wouldn't even think of trying to reach are godly because that woman got up and didn't say, "I cannot." When God spoke to her. When God spoke to her. Margaret Spencer Johnson. She was from nobility, okay? Not royalty. She was from the aristocracy of Britain. But she was so frail and so sickly that she was protected and cared for and pitied by everybody. She said, "God wants me to go to the streets of Europe and work and bring soul to Christ. They did everything. Her father was outraged. He literally declared war on every society, anything that would help her to do it. She went to Europe, sick. On the streets, she won so many souls to God that she shook Christianity. She shook evangelical Christianity. You want to read her book, the book written on her life. How many she brought to Christ on her knees in the streets from the gutters, in a time and an era when everybody, drug addicts, drunks, mental people, all thrown into one institution. There was no compassion, care, and true care for these people. She was in these buildings, government buildings, and she brought these people to Christ. One after the other turned to the Lord, and their lives transformed. Their lives able to go back out and face the world with God. And she died, a young woman, in her 30s. I think she was 36 when she died. But she died leading souls to Christ. So, you know, she didn't go to hospital and stuff. She didn't want to. Everyone knew. She had one woman who was just working for the sake of a job screamed at her. And said, "Why do you care like this for such people?" And she looked up, and a lot of people were in that situation listening as they looked at this frail woman trying to lead a soul to Christ and to help them out of the gutter. She said, "God never gave me up when I did not deserve His love or grace. And I shall never give up any soul on this earth that God can use me in His love through me to bring them to Jesus." She won multitudes in those years that she went where most people would say, protect her. She was consumed with a goal that God shook Christianity, evangelical circles around the world when they heard of this woman. In the end, many, many Christians went and joined that mission that basically was formed through her life and the fruit of her life, and were a force for God, driven when they were tired. She said to one woman who was saying, "You need to slow down," she said, "Listen to me, sister. When you feel you've got nothing left to give, try giving a little more. You'll be astonished how much you have left to give." Peggy Dobby. She cared for her godly father and mother, feeding them in their old age, washing them, and on her knees, reading the scriptures daily, hour after hour, singing hymns till death. She just cared. It was her goal, caring for these godly missionaries in their old age who had impacted Africa like few in the history of Africa were impacted as Captain Dobby and his wife. And she was a prayer warrior with them. When they died, she didn't just start it, but she was consumed with something that had built up through her life. She had a map on her wall in her lounge. Great big map with pins, colored pins, little tags. And downstairs under the color, underneath were all these files. Every mission society on earth that was evangelical and preaching truth, no matter what persuasion of denomination, but every single nation, she had every single document. If there was a mission that had a newsletter or some news way of getting that didn't get to those documents, it was really amazing. She didn't have one. She wasn't just interested in a certain section or a certain group or a certain denomination or certain doctrinal people who were thrust out. She was do you know this woman knew how many people with 300 million Arab, mostly Muslim, most of whom never heard the name Jesus Christ once in their lives. They haven't even heard of Jesus Christ. Most. Do you know that? How many people were there that were truly serving Christ across the whole of all these Arabian countries? These Muslim countries. In 300 million over. She knew the names. She knew where they were. She knew the dangers they were in. She could tell you their children, their ages. She could tell you their needs financially. She had found everything out. This woman was so interested intimately what to pray for. She prayed. She phoned me up. You can't believe 2:00 in the morning. There's no time to sleep. She was frail, by the way. She's 98 now. 99. She just turned 99. She was so frail. She says, they've taken them. They've taken them. They've killed the father. They've killed the mother. They've killed one or two of the children. Some of the missionaries have contacted us and said, well, they don't know where the one child is. It's hidden. We've got to pray that God keeps that child safe and the others to get out. They're killing them. The Christian people who are winning souls, who are actually missionaries. They're for one cause, to win these people to Christ. Pray. Pray with us now. Let's start praying. How do you get angry if someone wakes you up at 2 o'clock in the morning that's interested in someone who's about to die the other side of the world? They would phone. Missions would phone her from across the world because they knew here's a woman consumed. Consumed with a passion. Her, like Wesley, the world is my parish. Don't tell me that one wall or one denomination, the world, if Christ loved the world, if he gave his blood, if he died and tasted death for every man, the world is my parish. This woman's life cried that out. She was consumed for the whole world. She could tell you when they were sick and pray for them, their needs. How many missionaries? She was consumed with a goal, praying through. Oh, what a blessing it was to be in the presence of Miss Dobby. And the effort she went to make sure the whole world was on her heart, that to her capacity, by the grace of God, she was praying for every known missionary on this earth earnestly. Fasting, praying, calling on God, being meaningful. What do you do? Have you ever prayed once from your soul for the 300 million Arabs that are going to hell? And for those who are in lives are in danger, being there. Bless God for this woman. Mr. MacFarlane, in his old age, when he was frail, his wife was died. Here he is in his old age, preaching every now and again for the conventions where we asked him for one meeting. He spent his days on a tract that he had printed, hundreds of them, and he took the telephone directories. And he sent tracts home after home, district after district, to their addresses with a little personal letter. Please read this tract. Eternity awaits you, and I beg you, don't throw it away, that you may know why you had life and what God has done for you to be saved. Please read this tract and contact me if you need to by this phone. It is believed that he came close to one of the largest cities in our country to have got through the entire telephone directory. He didn't waste his time. He didn't waste his... Consumed. You know, in his 80s, 88, close to 89, one night, a man who gave him the cottage came to our home. It was about 4 in the morning. And I said, what's wrong? He said, brother, it's Mr. Mack. And I thought he was going to say, well, Mr. Mack has died or in hospital. I said, what happened? He said, brother, for the last few nights, his light has been on in the little cottage all night. So last night, I've been thinking, was the old man forgetting to put his light off and just falling asleep? So I went out last night, brother. And I looked through the glass panes of the window, and he wasn't in his bed. And I said, at this time of the night, where is he? And I looked down on the floor. There he was on his face, 88. Years of age, groaning. At first I thought it was you, but then I heard him groaning, oh God, tears coming down the face, on his face, while other people, young, haven't spent 1 minute in 24 hours for weeks sincerely groaning for any soul on this earth. This man was groaning to God for our country. It was facing what the world thought would be a bloodbath because of apartheid. Don't let the devil destroy this land, God. Protect this land under the blood of Christ. Rebuke Satan. He went on, oh God, this land still must be brought back to God. Don't let the devil win. Groaning, weeping. You think South Africa didn't face a bloodbath simply because of politics like Mandela? No, there wouldn't have been a Mandela. If it wasn't for the godly blacks and whites groaning before God. But how many? But God had an obligation. And our nation was saved, I believe, through men like that, who were consumed with the things of God and the souls and the lands, though they were 80s. This man said, "Brother, I went back inside. And I was so shaken, the first thought came to me, I haven't spent 1 minute in my life, even though my whole country is falling apart, and blood could flow any day, millions could be killed in a war that could break out between all the different sections of this country and its divisions. I hadn't honestly groaned on my face for this nation." Here was a man who's groaning through the night. He says, I went back to bed, but I couldn't sleep. It was about 2 hours later, brother. I got up and the light was still on. I said, "No, not 2 hours, God, no." I went, he was still on his face, brother, weeping. And he didn't know I was listening, groaning, calling on God. He died prematurely. He would have lived years later. He died. The reason why that man died. He died because he was burdened for this world, for souls, for nations, for his nation, in a way most people went to bed, even if tomorrow we lost everything, and died with bloodbath. No one was praying like that, that I know, other than he, that I personally know. If there was any reason God spared South Africa, it was such men, sir. Such men. Who didn't say, "No, I'm too old. I need to go to sleep now. No matter what comes, leave it to the young ones, you know." No, I could go on and on and on and on with all these lovely illustrations of so many, so many. And you? Tell me, just how much is your life laid on the altar for God, consumed with what God has told you because your life was right? And so while this world perishes and your country deteriorates so rapidly that I'd hate to know, you'll be scared to open your front door one day in the wave of moral decadence. And are you groaning before God or doing something to stop it? In your capacity, even if it's your prayers? From the youngest child to the oldest saint, tell me, you remember when Isaiah heard the voice of God, became conscious suddenly for the first time in his life, God was actually looking. Whom shall I send? Can you believe it? God asks us, who? Whom shall I send? Who will go for us? He was conscious God was seeking someone to use, to lay his life down and say, "Here am I. Send me. Here, take me. Take my life. For what thou art looking for, here's me, God." And how many sitting here tonight, through this message brought in great weakness, through someone very base and nothing really, but in his weakness trying every breath in his body, not to waste one day, not 1 hour, not one opportunity to be used of God. Somehow you hear, conscious suddenly, God is longing to use you. But have you said, "Young or old, here am I. Take life, what's left of it. Have it, God. Whatever it is, just guide me. Take me. Impress on my heart what it is I am to do for God, to be consumed with, whether I'm in my 80s, whether I'm a woman, whether I'm a child. God, I don't want to waste another minute that could be fulfilling what God has in mind for me, to be used of God in this world, before this moment called life is gone that I have for eternity to do something for Christ and souls. Here am I, God. Take my life. Let it be consecrated to Thee. Take my moments from this moment on till I die. Take everything, every faculty of my being, my intellect, everything that is available. I put it now available to Thee. Whatever the purpose of God, here am I. God, send me. How many need to do that tonight from their souls in a way heaven will look, be obliged to look and take hold of you and take you into the fulfilling of God's heart for your life too, what you can do. How many of you need to say that to God right now? From your soul, and you've never said it from your soul. And you need to tonight desperately. I want those of you that really would say that to God tonight and know that God's speaking to you. I want you to stand.